Today's Teisho is on Case 23 in the Book of Serenity. Case 23 is entitled, Lu Zhu Faces the Wall. I wonder if you would do me a favor and not take notes.
I was just writing the title.
Okay.
Is that right?
Yes, it's okay.
Sorry.
I'll explain in just a moment. You didn't do anything wrong. I'll explain. Lu Zhu Faces the Wall. Introduction. Bodhidharma's 9 years is called wall gazing. Shengguan's 3 bows divulge the natural potential. How can you sweep away the tracks and obliterate the traces? Case. Whenever Lu Zhu saw a monk coming, he would immediately face the wall. Nansen, hearing of this, said, I usually tell them to realize mastery before the empty aeon, to understand before the Buddhas appear in the world. Still, I haven't found one or a half. Lu Zhu, that way, will go on till the year of the ass. Verse. In plainness, there's flavor. Subtly transcending thought and expression, continuously seeming to exist before any sign. Unbending, like an idiot, his path is lofty. Jade, when a pattern is carved, loses its purity. A pearl in an abyss attracts of itself. A thoroughly clear air burnishes sweltering autumn, pure. A bit of cloud at leisure divides sky and waters afar. So, this is what is called a koan. In Zen practice, we believe it's quite important to have some understanding of what you're doing. So if you come on a Saturday like today, there'll be a talk on Zen practice like this talk. And I will do my best to elucidate some of the principles of Zen practice in the course of my talk. You know, when we're not here together and you're not practicing, if you want to read some sutras, please do. So, you know, I highly recommend the Heart Sutra. It's a really wonderful sutra, and it's the cornerstone of Zen, of the Zen tradition. So reading the Diamond Sutra would be a really interesting experience. It's not that hard to understand, and mercifully, it's not that long. In the Mahayana, in the tradition of Buddhism that Zen comes out of, there are some sutras that are far from short. One of my favorite sutras in the world is the Hua Yan Sutra, the Flower Ornament Sutra. It's 600 pages long. It's taken me about 30 years to read it. I might have missed a few parts. It's magnificent. It's amazing, and it had a big impact on Zen. Another sutra is called the Lankavatara Sutra, the Descent into Sri Lanka Sutra. And it's also pretty long and pretty hard to understand. One of our members actually wanted to do some reading with me, and he wrote me and said, I'd like to read some of the key Zen sutras with you. So I actually said, let's start at the beginning of the Mahayana. Let's read what is called the Prajnaparamita literature. And this is really wonderful, wonderful literature. Prajnaparamita was a movement in Buddhism about 1,000 years after the Buddha was born. And the Prajnaparamita people said, we are all trying to wake up. And there are some people who are very unusual, who have really fully wakened up. But, maybe it's fundamentally a big mistake to think they're special in some way. And they said, isn't it possible that consciousness itself is already enlightened? And they decided that was true. So instead of thinking about humanity as being divided into people who are on awake and people who are awake, the Prajnaparamita people said, actually, we're all fundamentally enlightened. We just don't always know it. But consciousness itself is fundamentally enlightened. Well, that was a revolution in Buddhism. And until then, it's probably the case that most people thought that their own everyday mind was full of obstacles and obstructions, and also defiled. The word the early sutras use for obstacles is not obstacles, but they say defilements. Defilements. So defiling is a complicated matter, right? You defile something that's pure by making it impure. So early Buddhists may have thought that they were defiled, that they were impure or dirty in some way. And so when they practiced, they were trying to clean themselves up, trying to undefile themselves. When the Prajnaparamita people came along, they were deep meditators, people who practiced meditation day and night. And they said, this just doesn't square with our deepest experience of awakened mind. In awakened mind, we can see that everything is pure. Nothing is defiled. So this was like a real revolution. And ordinary people realized that their condition was not as hopeless at all, that fundamentally consciousness is already awake. Anyway, I gave this book, this which I think is just wonderful, to my student, who has, advanced degrees in the sciences. And then we got on Skype, and I said, well, what did you think? And he said, I can't make head nor tails of this thing. I can't understand a word of it. So, he's an intelligent guy, and it is written in a very difficult, kind of a weird, funny style. Almost like if you wanted to make fun of philosophy, you'd write this way. I said, okay, let's try an easier book. And I said, let's try the Lankavatara Sutra. And then we had our Skype meeting, and he said, I can't make heads or tails of this. And I said, okay, let's try an easier book. Let's try the Diamond Sutra. And that was doable, right? So I definitely recommend the Diamond Sutra. If you have 30 years to spare, you can read the Hua Hien Sutra, the Flower Ornament Sutra. We do think in Zen that it's important to understand what Buddhism is all about. You should probably read a few books on Buddhism and a few books on Zen. Earlier I asked somebody in the room not to take notes because, this is actually the subject of a koan in a way. I couldn't have paid that person to... Maybe I paid that person to do that. The case, whenever Luzu saw a monk coming, he would immediately face the wall. Nan Sen, hearing of this, said, I usually tell them to read some books on Buddhism first before they practice Zen. To understand things a little bit before really going down this road. And he says, but I haven't been that successful. And then he says, but Luzu, that method will never work. He will keep doing that until the year of the ass, and that, in other words, forever. So, he said, I've been trying to teach Zazen, but I've been saying, let's start with the sutras, and then let's do Zazen. And he's just saying, let's start with Zazen. Whenever anything happens, sit on your ass and do Zazen. He said, well, that'll never work. So, remember that in Zen, when somebody says that somebody's a dope or somebody's hopeless, he means that he's brilliant and he's got a good idea. So he's really paying Lu Zhu a big compliment. It is very important to read sutras. It's exciting, they're interesting. If you don't understand them, you have to rethink things, and that's wonderful. In the Tibetan tradition, they don't really allow you in most Tibetan traditions to do what we do, meditation practice, until you've really become quite advanced. Monks in training in Tibet and nuns in training in Tibet spend years studying the sutras before they actually do the kind of very advanced practice that Zen starts with. We start with like advanced practice. This is a little bit like in Japan. I don't know if this is still true, but it used to be the case. When Genki Roshi, my first teacher, came here from Japan, he wanted to drive. And I said, oh, fine. And I gave him this little booklet. And he read the little booklet. And then we put him in like a little driver's school, like 3 days of driver's instruction. And then he got his license, and he was astounded. Because in Japan, it's incredibly hard to get a driver's license. You have to study this big book. Serious, maybe it's changed, but you really have to the book used to, Genki Roshi said the book was all about like how a car works, You had to understand, I know how a car works. You turn the key and the engine goes on. You press the gas and it goes forward. I have a stick shift, so you depress the clutch, right? And if you don't want to crash, you put on the brake. Done. Stop at a red light. Don't run anybody over. Don't hit any cars. I understand the rules of the road. In Japan, you have to really understand how a car works. So there's actually questions on the exam about, the internal combustion engine. And if this is a problem, what is likely to be the, if this is happening, what's likely to be the problem? So you really have to study for the driver's license in Japan, and it's quite an accomplishment. He got his driver's license, he read this pamphlet, he took these three ditzy little courses, and he got his driver. He was amazed that we do this. Well, Zen is a little bit, in this case, less like the Japanese model or the Tibetan model, and it's more like the American model. Let me give you three little lessons, and now here are the keys. Good luck, Zen works like that, People come in, and I say, here's how you sit on the cushion. Here's why we're sitting on a cushion. Here's how you watch your breath. Here are the keys. Good luck. So in a certain way, the Japanese must think we're crazy. And indeed we are, right? Because not only do we give people, a car, we give them you don't have to take any lessons and we'll give you a gun, right? So not everything we do is a good idea. But there might be something good about just giving people the keys to their cushion and saying, go ahead and drive it. You know, Zen is based on, Zen comes out of the Prajnaparamita movement. You know, there's a very famous koan about a monk and his master. And the monk was doing Zazen day and night, day and night. And by the way, I do a lot of Zazen myself, and I love it. And there's, and I, if I could get away with it, I'd probably do it day and night. And shortly, we will be doing it all day anyway. But you know, he was doing it day and night, day and night. And when the bell would ring and all the other monks would go to take a rest or have dinner, he would stay. He'd be sitting on his cushion. And the master saw this, and you know, one day all the monks had gone to take a shower, and this one monk was in the zendo, in the meditation hall. And the master came in and sat next to him, and the master had a brick in his hand. And he took a cloth out of his sleeve, and started rubbing this brick with a cloth. You know, so the student is sitting there trying to meditate, and he sees his teacher come in with a brick, and the guy's sitting right next to his student, and he's rubbing this. You know, after a while, you have to ask, right? It's like, I'll take the bait, you know. So he says, what are you doing rubbing that cloth on that brick? And the teacher says, I'm polishing this brick to make it a mirror. And the student says, you can polish it forever, but it will never turn into a mirror. And the teacher goes, exactly. So if you're polishing your mind to turn it into a mirror and it's a brick, nothing you do will ever, ever make it shine. See, it's already a mirror. You don't really have to polish it in the way you think. See, I mean, this is an interesting issue, right? You know, some religions actually teach that people are fundamentally evil. And I have to say that when I read the political news, I almost think that might be true. But if people are fundamentally evil, then it's like the brick, right? How could they ever, ever do anything good? But actually, if you look around, you see everywhere the evidence of human compassion. You know, just everywhere you turn, if you just go into a store, or if you... The other day I was, you know, I went into a grocery store, and a woman is, you know, trying to find a home for these kittens she's found. And she, you know, she wasn't just giving them out. She wanted to make sure people would really take care of these kittens. So I was deeply moved, you know. Here's evidence... Yes, there is Donald Trump, but on the other hand, you know, this is somebody who's spending her day trying to take care of these little animals that she found, you know, and is actually concerned about their welfare. You know, so I think the evidence of human goodness is everywhere. You know, so how would that be possible if people are basically bad, right? So you know, there's this idea that... you know, the Buddhist idea, and the Mahayana idea in particular, the Prajnaparamita idea, is that people are fundamentally awake. They just get confused. And this is, I think, absolutely true. If you do Zazen persistently, mm-hmm. and you eventually have like a great awakening experience, you know, one of the things that you realize is that this has been there all the time. I just didn't notice it. And that sounds strange to say, but it seems so self-evident after you've had the experience. Well, you know, the Prajnaparamita people said exactly that. They said, it's there all the time, you just get confused. And so Zen practice isn't about trying to free yourself from defilements. It's just trying to clear away some of the confusion so that you can become who you really were all along, this radiant, compassionate Buddha mind. So Zen practice is based on the idea that we can trust ourselves. So we can trust ourselves. Now, you know, we all make a lot of mistakes in our life. We've all made a huge number of mistakes. We've hurt people. We've hurt ourselves. We've done incredibly self-indulgent, self-destructive things. If you, at some point in your life, you begin to remember all the crappy things you did to your mother, and it's just horrifying. You know, you think, "Oh my, did I really say that to my mother? Why didn't she beat me to a pulp?" You know, and she didn't. She was nice to me. Amazing, right? A bratty teenager, you know. So that's all true. But nevertheless, you know, we can trust ourselves. Now, you know, as I was saying earlier, you know, there are different, within Buddhism, there's different attitudes, you know, like in Tibet is the other attitude, right? And I'm not criticizing. It's just a different approach, right? You know, Tibetan people, you know, they train their monks, they read all the sutras, they really have to understand how the car works before they get the keys. And, you know, the Tibetan tradition here in the United States, in many Tibetan centers, you know, before they'll allow you to really practice, you have to do like 1,000 bows or something like that. They'll give you you have to just do a lot of prostrations. You know, and if you do enough prostrations, you begin to realize this is a form of meditation, right? And even if you don't realize it's a form of a meditation, you realize you have to do it to get to what you really want, which is the esoteric instruction. But in Zen, you know, people come in and I say, here's how we bow, this is what it looks like. You don't have to do it if you don't want to. You know, there's a fair number of people, maybe 25%, who won't do it. You know, and that's okay. They don't have to bow. And I'm waiting for them to discover bowing. You know, maybe 20 years down the road, they okay, I'll bow. And somebody bows and realizes, oh, that is really a profound practice. Really a profound practice to bow. You know, the bow. In Tibet, when people are on a religious pilgrimage, they get to the Potala Palace. They actually do full prostration from a certain point. They actually do full prostrations all the way to the Potala Palace. So it's like they just keep fully prostrating themselves all the way to this sacred site. And, you know, you don't have to do that, but if you bow wholeheartedly, you realize this is a wonderful practice. You know, I lift my fears and I lift my enlightened mind above my fears and attachments. You know, to do a full prostration is really an expression of humility, which is, by the way, why so many people don't want to do it. And it's like profound humility. You know, also compassion. You know, also, I think, compassion. There's so many dimensions to bowing that you will experience if you try it. You know, so what happens in the Zen tradition is that people bow for a long time and they think, yeah, the bows. And then one day they do a bow and realize, what the hell was that? What was that? That's amazing, right? Bowing is amazing. So, you know, it being told it's amazing is one thing, but discovering it's amazing is another thing. And Zazen is like that too. You know, it's possible for somebody to give you a lecture on a Zen practice, and I'm sort of doing that now. But, you know, we want to be careful not to to ruin the experience for you by telling you what you should be having, what you should be experiencing. And that does create a lot of problems. I mean, I try to always, you know, when I took my vows to be a priest, I promised not to lie. you know, which is a hugely difficult. The other vows are much easier than that. You know, actually, promising not to lie is a hugely difficult promise. You know, in my job, for example, you know, sometimes it's very difficult to, I have to be very clever not to tell the truth in a way that isn't actually a lie. You know? But you know, sometimes you can't tell the truth. You have to say something that's appropriate. And you have to be careful, if you've promised not to lie, not to lie. So, you know, when I talk about my own Zen practice, in this context, I always tell the truth. You know, I'm honor-bound to say this is what is happening to me on the cushion. So sometimes I'll say this happens to me on the cushion. My body disappears. I'm watching my breath and I feel my hands and my face disappear and then my body seems to empty out. And that happened to my teacher too. You know, Genki Roshi used to say he felt like a stick of incense. He'd sit on the cushion and his body would just disappear, like a stick of incense burning down to the ground. And when it got to the ground, he was gone. All that he had was like a little bit of sensation in his, you know, breathing sensation, hearing, a little bit of sensation in his hands. And, you know, other people who do a lot of meditation know this territory pretty well. But, you know, when I do talk about that kind of experience, there, sometimes somebody will come up to me and say, "Can I talk to you?" And I'll say, "Sure," and we'll go in the other room, and they sit down and they say, "You know, I just feel like I'm doing everything wrong." And I'll say, "Why?" You know, and they say, "Because I'm not having any of the experiences you describe. You know, I don't feel like my hands are disappearing. I don't feel like my, you know, this is really, you know, I'm really just screwing up. What am I, I'm wasting my time, you know." And then I have to try to say, "Well, look, you know, your experience of Zen is going to be your experience of Zen. Who cares if you have my experience of Zen?" But most people don't have enough confidence necessarily to say, "Well, you know, he's probably telling the truth, but maybe my experience will be different." You know, so we don't always trust ourselves, but Zen is based on the idea that, you know, you learn to trust yourself. You learn. You can't tell somebody who doesn't trust himself, "Well, just trust yourself." If you don't trust yourself, that's cold comfort, right? But, you know, what Zen does is it puts you in a situation where you're kind of trapped or you're kind of boxed in. You know, we had 5 sits in a row this morning. If you came early in the morning, you did 3 sits. And then we have a bathroom break, and then we have 2 more. And between the individual sitting periods, there's no break. So, in the middle of the second one, if you did the first one, you know, you're probably really wondering, you know, can I make it through this? Especially if you're new to Saturday sit. And maybe you even think, "I'll never make it through this, right? I'll never be able to do this." But then you do, and you say to yourself, where did that come from? You know, I was sure I couldn't do this, and I did it. You know, the same thing happens at Sesshin. You know, if you're doing meditation all day long, and by the second day you say, "Oh, I'll never be able to finish this thing. You know, I'm already exhausted." But then, you know, something happens, and you discover you can do it. You know, so little by little, people develop, they learn how to trust themselves, even though, you know, most people aren't very trusting of themselves. So that's sort of like the Zen approach, It's the teaching method of Zen. It's not to give you a lecture and say, "Here's what should be happening. Check, the Tibetan is a little more like a checklist. Here's the checklist, you know, check them off, you know." The Zen approach is more like, you know, here's the car, here are the keys, you figure out how to drive it. Just try not to hit any trees. But if you hit a tree, you know, that doesn't mean you're an idiot. We all hit trees sometime. You just have to remember what you did wrong. So, Zen puts you in situations where you have to rely on yourself. You know, you're sitting even in this morning. You know, you go through one sit, two sits, and then you think, I don't think I'll make it through this third sit, but you do it. And you realize, I wonder where that came from. You know, and if you go to Sashin, you do 8 hours of sitting a day, and by the second day you think, there's no way I can finish this thing, but then you do. You think, I wonder where that came from, right? And so the whole approach in Zen is to, you know, even koans are like this, you know. There's a person in our group, I gave him a koan recently. And he got so dejected, right? He just said, oh my God, you know, I just feel so trapped by this koan. Now, if you're a Zen teacher, that's music to your ears, right? I mean, that's exactly what you want them to say. And people think, oh my God, you know, I'll never work my way out of this. You know, I'll be doing this koan until I'm 90 years old. But, no trust, right? No trust. And then you sit there with the koan and you think, I'll never get this. Finally, you realize, okay, I'll never get this. Who cares? I for some reason, I want to be here. And then, you know, the koan actually becomes interesting. It's like, where is this taking me anyway? You know, and then if you let the koan really take you someplace, it takes you someplace. And then you come in, and you know, when you reach the point where you don't give a damn whether you answer your koan or not, you usually are ready to answer your koan. Because it's no longer about answering the koan, it's interesting. It's like, where is this taking me? You see, that's when that happens, you're doing well. You know, that's good. So it's a different procedure than we're used to. In school, nobody does this, right? In school, you know, you get a biology you get a biology textbook, and it says the plants take in oxygen, or the plants take in CO2, and they expel oxygen, blah blah blah. And you know, it'd be better. You know, the Zen approach would be here are some plants. Try to keep them alive. You know, in the building, and you know, you'd lose a lot of plants, but you'd eventually figure it out. And actually, that would work very well as a way of teaching. You know, because if you have some kind of an investment in what you're learning, you're a much better learner. You know, if it's a textbook, you think, oh, somebody else has already figured all this out. Who really cares? You know? It's like my brother, you know, my brother was a biology major, but he was a minor in business. And he actually had a business. It was that lasted for 25 years. And he would have all these dilemmas. And I would say, well, Peter, didn't you study this in your business courses? And it was like, are you kidding? This is real business, you know. He learned so much more running his business than he ever learned from these courses. Now, I'm not knocking the courses, but. You know, when you're in the middle of it, you know, that's where you really have an investment. You have to. Well, this is a Zen training, you know. If you say, when somebody tells you all is one, it's like, oh please, you know, that's just an idea. How threadbare. You know, when you're struggling on your cushion and you feel totally cut off from the answer, and then you break through, well then all is one. Right, then you've known it in your flesh and in your bones, right? In your flesh and in your bones. It's the rest. You know, I will often tell Zen students, you know, that's too abstract. That's too intellectual. You know, that's you didn't have to do any zazen to come up with that answer. You know, I want to see. You know, I want to hear it from your flesh and your bones. Then we know it's real. Something you discovered yourself. Right? You discover yourself. So you know, this koan is all about this very issue. You know? You can imagine a Zen teacher, you know, when monks approach his temple and he sees them coming, instead of going out to greet them, he runs right into the Zendo, sits down and faces the wall. starts doing zazen. And, you know, if these are new trainees, they think to themselves, what the hell is going, what's with him? What's he doing? I have no, you know, there was actually a wonderful book. I think it was called, it's by a man named Clark Strand. And it's called something like The Wooden Bowl. But it, he talks about his first experience with Buddhism was with a Chinese monk. And Clark Strand was going to, I can't remember where it was, but it was someplace like the University of Kentucky or something. And he was, you know, very, like all of us, you know, he was a very confused young man, or very confused young man, very confused young woman. And he was getting some degree at the University of Kentucky, and somehow he heard that a Buddhist monk was in town. I guess this would be, I think this is Louisville, I don't remember, but. Anyway, you know, he had a car, so he drove out and he found this guy, this Buddhist monk, living in this little house in Kentucky. And he said, you know, I want to learn about Buddhism. And this, I think this monk's name was Dejun. Dejun didn't tell him anything. He says, well, come Tuesday morning. And the guy came on Tuesday morning, and there was a cushion for him, and Dejun just started meditating. And Clark Strand said, you know, I didn't know what to do. You know, and I sat there, and I didn't know what to do. And then after about an hour, Dejun said, okay, thank you. See you, you know, please come back. And Clark Strand came back. And he practiced with this guy for a couple years. And then he decided to go to study with Edo Shimano Roshi in New York at a temple. And it was a much more conventional way to study Zen. And he said, you know, when he said goodbye to Dejun, he felt a little sad, and Dejun seemed sad. And he said, it took me years to realize that, you know, Edo Roshi, as a Zen teacher, was only so-so. But Dejun was a great Zen teacher, because he never gave me any instruction. And I actually agree. I mean, you know, we live in the real world, and people need some instruction. But, you know, Dejun was a real person of Zen. He really understood the Zen pedagogy, you know. If you sit there long enough, you'll begin to pay attention to your breath. You know, you have nothing else to pay attention to. And if you pay attention to your breath, you'll notice that it's, okay, it goes in and out, but guess where it takes you? You know, it takes you to a very interesting place where there's nothing at all. You know, I mean, my own teacher gave me some instructions, but he was very close to Dejun. Genki wouldn't tell you anything. You know, he would say things mysteriously like, Where is the breath with eyes? Or, you know, something like that, you know. And once I experienced it, I realized, oh my gosh, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about. But he didn't give you much help. And that could, that at the time, it seemed perverse. Why don't you just tell me what you want me to do? But I realize now how he was teaching me to have confidence in my true nature, in my true self. And I had none. And, you know, I was waiting for the instruction manual to come, right? I wanted the you know, in math in high school, there was your book, and then the teacher had the book with the answers in the back. I wanted the one with the answers in the back. So, you know, definitely, Dejun was a deeper practitioner of Zen than Edo Shimano. Clark Strand really realized that in retrospect. What a great lesson he learned from this person, just to trust. You know, so when we have a Teisho like this, this is called a Teisho. It's not, Teisho doesn't actually mean lecture. It means offering. So, the teacher is not supposed to have any notes. There are American Zen teachers who have notes, but there shouldn't be any notes, because I would say that shows a lack of trust. It's even kind of cheating to try to prepare the talk. You just come in, you pick a koan or you don't, you do the sutras, you do five sits, and then you just say, well, let's see what turns up. And sometimes it's not much to brag about. But sometimes, I'm amazed. It's like, where did that come from? I didn't do that. That's very coherent. How did that happen? It's trusting your big mind. It takes a long time. I've been doing this forever, when I first did it, I would agonize. Why didn't I talk about this? Did I say that? Oh my God, I hope they didn't misunderstand. It's crazy to do that, I don't control this. I'm just present. I'm just present. Let the big mind do the work, right? So this is really deep trust. This is the method of Zen. See? And so, basically the typical Zen student in say, Japan or China goes to a university and does read sutras, but then practices Zen, and then goes back and reads the sutras a second time, and this time understands what they're talking about. Because you've been there, right? I know that. The method of Zen is not knowing. See, when we're in a situation where we don't know, that's the perfect situation to come alive. I'm a teacher, and if you teach your subject, if you teach I teach writing now, but I used to teach poetry. And I love poetry. And I would bring these poems into my students that, I had spent hundreds of hours writing about or thinking about. And I would bring them into my students and, I was expecting I would toss these poems in the room and it would be like a bomb going off, And, they were sitting there thinking, when is lunch? And I got, I realized this is not how to teach, I'm giving them my treasures and expecting them to have the same reaction. Maybe I should just, try to mix it up and let's let them have a reaction, which is their reaction. I can remember being in many classes where it was just, when is lunch? For me too. The best thing in the world is to be trapped, to not know. And to be, on fire with not knowing. That's the koan training method, right? It's not pleasant to be given a problem you can't work through. And the more time you invest, the more desperate you become for the answer. But, this is like perfect. Perfect. Because at some point, you really do give up. And when you give up, you shift into this other mode, which is your big mind. The same thing happens at Sesshin. Around day three of Sesshin, day two of Sesshin, people think, that's it. Where are my car keys? In fact, in some Zen centers, they actually make people turn over the car keys? That's true. Kriti told me they do that up in Rochester Zen Center. You have to give them the car keys. Wow. Well, you can keep your car keys at our group, in our place. And you'll be wanting to use them a day two. And if you go, it'll be a great tragedy because you won't be encountering, you will be selling yourself short, You'll be selling yourself short. Because there's inside you, there is this Buddha mind. And it does take a little desperation to get there. But, you think, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it, and then suddenly you do it, effortlessly. And it's like, where did that come from? Now, we think we know who we are, but we don't. We don't. We don't have a clue. But when you encounter that, you know, that stranger in yourself, you know, you amaze yourself. But it's not easy to do. You have to be uncertain. You have to be struggling. You know, that's when you wake up, right? That's when you wake up. As long as you're saying, oh, yes, I know that. Oh, yes, I understand. Oh, I remember that. I remember that lecture, you know. Nothing much can happen. You know, I think this is why, by the way, you know, in like so many, like in the sciences, people make so many discoveries when they're young. You know, like Einstein was like this very young man when he came up with these three papers that just, they were like major, each one was like a major achievement. You know, and I think it's because people are, at that age, they expect to be confused, you know. And they're not, they expect it, and they're, it's okay. When you get older, you don't want to be confused, you want to be in control. And that's a big problem. You know, it's so, nothing can be, can really be learned. Nothing really comes alive unless you pass through that door of not knowing. So even when we, you know, when we listen to Teishos, you know, we don't take notes because if you're holding on to the ideas, that's it's okay, but it's not enough trust. So you just listen, you know, just listen. You don't have to remember anything. Don't worry about that. Just watch your breath and let the words flow over you. You know, Gary Snyder and this other guy whose name escapes me right now, the poet Gary Snyder, both studied with this Roshi in Japan. And his temple was on the coast, and they would get these torrential rains. And he would give his teishos in the middle of these torrential rains. The wind was howling. And he had a tiny little voice, you know. He would just speak in this sort of mumbly voice. And none of his students could hear him, you know, or they could barely hear him. And Gary Snyder actually said, you know, he got a letter from his friend, and it was like 30 years later. And the friend wrote Gary Snyder and said, you remember those lectures that Roshi used to give? You know, I could barely hear him. He said, boy, I'm hearing him now. You know, that's hearing with, you have an ear on each side of your head, but you have another ear. You're listening with the ear of your true self. You know, you'll remember everything when you need to. Bodhidharma's 9 years of facing the wall is called Pikwan. Shengguan's three bowing divulge the natural potential. How can you sweep away the tracks and obliterate the traces? In other words, how can you get beyond your cliched thinking and your tired habits of experience and experience something new? Let's see. Case. Whenever Lu Zhu saw a monk coming, he would immediately enter into deep muxin. Nansen, hearing of this, said, I usually try to teach them about the Dharma before I put them on the cushion. But I haven't had that much success. Lu Zhu, that way, will never, you know, he'll be sitting until the year of the ass. No, that'll never work. But of course, that's the method of Zen. In plainness, there's flavor. Subtly transcending thought and expression, continuously seeming to exist before any sign. You know, when you're lost, there's no signs, right? Subtly transcending thought before you can figure it out, before you can describe it in words, you're at a place where there's no signposts. You stand there like an idiot. And And then your path is lofty. Path is lofty. See, when you don't know where you're going, you are like the wind. You know, you're like the wind. You're like the waves. You're like the clouds. They have no map. It's lofty. Jade, when you carve a pattern into it, loses its purity. A pearl on somebody's hand is just like ho-hum, ho-hum. A pearl that has dropped into an abyss attracts creatures, you know, from heaven and earth. All the fish swim down to look at this mysterious pearl. A thoroughly clear air burnishes sweltering autumn pure. A bit of cloud at leisure divides sky and waters.